place have to do with ending China's structural attacks on the U.S. economy.
China trade war, or should we not call it that? It's Friday, November 8th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You're part of the program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, strong words for the North Koreans for the leader of Japan. We pay a visit to Asia in America. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China's Commerce Ministry said Thursday that China and the United States have agreed to roll back some of the tariffs each side imposed on the other's goods during their ongoing trade dispute. Ministry spokesman Gong Feng said at a news briefing, if negotiators reach a phase one agreement in trade talks, then both the United States and China should reduce the tariffs by the same amount and at the same time. The overall size of the reductions, Zhou said, would be determined as part of the negotiations. China and the U.S. imposed multiple rounds of tariffs on billions of dollars worth of goods. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro told VOA's Mandarin service a phase one deal would address some U.S. complaints with China's trade policies, including things like currency manipulation, forced technology transfers, and intellectual property theft, but that an overall trade agreement would have to accomplish more.
Trade war is a misnomer. The negotiations that are taking place have to do with ending China's structural attacks on the U.S. economy. It has to do with things like hacking our business computers, forcing technology transfer, stealing intellectual property theft, manipulating currency, and the like. The Phase One deal addresses several of those, but we're going to have all three phases of the deal in order to have a good deal.
From what I read, they are...
Joining us on VOA Asia is Alan Deardorff, professor of international economics at the University of Michigan. Professor, where do you think the U.S.-China trade negotiations stand?
And it sounds like they want us to think, and I hope they're right, that they're going to come to an agreement to reduce some tariffs, as well as doing the things they've been saying for a couple of weeks, getting China to buy more of our agricultural products and our promising not to raise tariffs any further. That was disappointing that that's all they talked about a couple of weeks ago. That they're now talking about lowering some tariffs is a good sign, and I hope it will happen. I'm not confident that it will because, gosh, now how long has it been? These negotiations have been going on and off and off and on for quite some time. And they thought they were getting close to a deal, a long time ago. And then it all fell apart. When each side claimed the other backed out. And I suppose that could easily happen again. But it does seem that they genuinely want to reach a deal, and what you just described sounds reasonably plausible. Whether the Chinese are willing to give up on some of the intellectual property issues, I think they will probably claim they already are behaving fine, but maybe they will persuade us that there will be some way of monitoring what they do and change their behavior or enforce it, prove that they're behaving well, and we might be satisfied with that.
How big of a problem is this posing, this U.S.-China trade? If you're not going to call it a war, what are you going to call it?
I certainly would say it's a trade war. I've been saying that for a long time, and so have most others. Why exactly they would say it's not a trade war, I don't know. That just seems silly. A trade war is pretty much, in my view, defined as countries raising tariffs against each other's imports and responding to the others putting up tariffs by putting up their own tariffs and just going back and forth. And that's exactly what we've been doing. I think it's a trade war. And I do think it's a big problem. It is, of course, interfering with trade between the U.S. and China, but it's having all sorts of adverse spillover effects across the world. They're not all adverse. There are some places that benefit from this, markets that can sell to us because we're not buying from China, or sell to China because they're not buying from us. But for the most part, it's been harmful in so many different ways. It would be wonderful if this whole thing could get resolved. And I think what's talked about here, this phase one agreement, it's not going to end it by any means. There's no way they're going to simply get rid of all the tariffs that both have put on. But if they could make some progress in reducing them, and that might encourage them to continue negotiating further, yeah, that would be good.
Alan Deardorff is professor of international economics at the University of Michigan, joining us on VOA Asia. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. A court in China sentenced 9 people Thursday for trafficking fentanyl into the United States. The 39 people who were found dead on the back of a refrigerated truck after being smuggled into Britain last month all came from Vietnam and have been formally identified. Ford Motor Company will consider building Ford-branded pickup trucks in China if restrictions on driving picks up in cities are relaxed, and it could also roll out customized models at that time. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. No more Mr. Nice Guy from North Korea, at least as far as Japan's leader is concerned. North Korea Thursday called Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe an idiot and villain who should not even dream of setting foot in Pyongyang. That in a media commentary laden with insults in response to his criticism of a North Korean weapons test. North Korea tested what it called super-large multiple rocket launchers on October 31st, but Japan said they were like ballistic missiles that violated UN sanctions. Abe condemned the test at an Asian summit this week, while saying he was eager to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un without conditions to resolve the issue of Japanese nationals abducted by the isolated state, according to the Kyoto News Agency. In 2002, North Korea admitted that its agents had kidnapped 13 Japanese from the 1960s to the 1980s. Japan says 17 of its citizens were abducted, 5 of whom were repatriated. North Korea has said 8 of them were dead, another 4 never entered the country. Happening now in Asia, Singapore police said on Thursday they're investigating an alleged meeting at a bar last month held to discuss anti-government protest in Hong Kong. That would be a possible breach of the city-state's law against unauthorized public assembly. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The capital of Asia, America, is one description used for an area spanning 36 kilometers just east of downtown Los Angeles called the San Gabriel Valley. Close to 500,000 Asians live in this region. It is an Asian enclave where 9 cities in the area are majority Asian. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on why so many Asians live there and the countries they represent.
The San Gabriel Valley, known to locals as the SGV, has been home to Mike Chow for 30 years. When he was 5 years old, his parents immigrated from Taiwan and chose the city of Walnut to settle down. It's a city that is majority Asian.
My parents, they didn't speak English at the time, so it's made it easier for them to kind of get around. It's so close to all the shopping. There's a good sense of that Asian community. It made fitting in a lot easier.
There's a largely immigrant and ethnic Chinese population in the SGV that started with a flood of people from Taiwan in the 1970s, then continued to trickle in the 80s when Chow arrived. Now he's a real estate agent and leads a multilingual team, including Roxanne Shung, who sells houses in the region.
Most of my clients are Mandarin-speaking. Chinese, but they're either living here and work here or study here, or they come to the United States just to invest, to buy investment property.
In the last 10 to 15 years, people from mainland China have become the new immigrants to the SGV. Originally from China, Sheng arrived in the U.S. for graduate school and stayed. She says there are many reasons why the SGV is attractive to the Chinese.
Everyone speaks Mandarin. They can walk into bank, post office, grocery stores. They can do everything without speaking English.
Immigrants are also attracted to Southern California's mild climate and relatively close distance to Asia when compared to other U.S. cities. For immigrants who are used to living in high-rise apartments in China,
we have plenty of single-family homes. They just buy the house, they get the land, they get the yard, and they have no neighbors up or down below them.
Immigrants from other Southeast Asian countries also live in the region.
So I speak Tagalog, the Hokkien, and Mandarin, and English.
Annie Xu came to the U.S. from the Philippines with her husband. Also a part of Mike Chow's real estate team, she has found homes for immigrants from Southeast Asia, such as the Philippines, Indonesia, and South Asia.
Newly built homes.
Shabana Khan is one of her clients who is looking for a house with a yard. She is Indian and Pakistani and moved to the SGV from New York.
New York has the vibe of the energy and stuff, but you can get it here too, you know. But as soon as you have kids, I think California is the best place to settle down. San Gabriel Valley is amazing. You have so many different cultures within Asia.
The diversity of Asian cultures here also means a variety of socioeconomic realities. A report by Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles estimates the undocumented Asian population to be 58,000 in the SGV, and close to a third of Asian Americans are low income.
Some of them just immigrated here. They haven't found a stable job, or their English is not good enough that they have to compromise for a job that's not ideal for them.
No matter what the socioeconomic status is, the Asian population in the San Gabriel Valley continues to grow because it is an area that makes the transition from an Asian culture to an American one much easier. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert, Cambodia has deployed troops and held live firing drills in preparation for the possible return this week of an opposition leader who is an arch rival of that country's strongman premier. Sam Rainsy, who has lived in France since 2015 to avoid jail for convictions, he says are politically motivated, has promised a dramatic return on November 9th, Cambodia's Independence Day. Let's turn our attention to Europe now. On Saturday, Germany celebrates the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Built in 1961 by the communist government of East Germany, the wall was meant to stop the flood of its citizens fleeing to the West. Hundreds were shot dead trying to flee across the frontier. Almost three decades later, on the night of November 9th, 1989, tens of thousands of people breached the wall and tore it down, seen as a key moment in the demise of the Soviet Union. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from Berlin, hopes that it would bring about peace between East and West have crumbled as fears grow of a new Cold War.
A giant wave holding aloft the hopes and memories of a people once divided by the Berlin Wall. 30,000 handwritten messages hang in front of the Brandenburg Gate. It was here in June 1987 that then US President Ronald Reagan uttered this now famous demand to his Soviet counterpart.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
2 years after President Reagan's speech, Germans themselves would tear down the wall in a dramatic show of people power that would have profound consequences for Germany, for Europe, and for the global order. In the Soviet bloc, pressure had been building for months. Pro-democracy protests spread to East Germany. On November 9th, an East German government spokesman said citizens were now free to travel to the West. The shock announcement was a bureaucratic slip, but East Germans flocked to the border. In the confusion, guards open the gates. Patrick Hartwig, then 19 years old, was among the first through. He went immediately to the Kurfürstendamm, a shopping district symbolic of Western capitalism. He now works in the very same street.
Dann habe ich die ganze Nacht da am Kudamm, ich habe auf irgendeinem BMW gesessen.
I spent the whole night on the Kurfürstendamm. I was sitting in a random BMW, a bottle of sparkling wine in my hand, and we honked up and down the Kurfürstendamm and had a wild night. 30 years later, I still think the changes were positive. It was a peaceful change.
The events of that night echoed across the world. A few weeks later, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and new US President George Bush announced the Cold War was over.
It seemed as if things were getting more peaceful, that the world was getting to a more peaceful place. Some even said this was the end of history.
By 1991, the Soviet Union had crumbled. But in the three decades since, tensions between East and West have reemerged.
NATO has taken in Poland, the Baltic states, and so on, have seen this as a threat. Although, of course, it wasn't meant as a threat. It wasn't an aggressive NATO which sort of had a drive to the East, but it was the East European countries who applied for NATO membership.
As the new century dawned, Vladimir Putin emerged as Russia's strongman, pledging to rebuild the country's pride and power. In Moscow, the events of 1989 are viewed very differently three decades on.
Gorbachev was is now much less accepted than he was then, because he is now seen not only as the person who gave away the GDR, but also as the person who destroyed the Soviet Union. And Putin is, I think, essentially trying to regain part of this Soviet hegemonic position in Europe.
In 2014, Russia forcefully seized Crimea and supported pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Relations between East and West have plunged. Russia and the United States are rearming. Moscow blames the West for missed opportunities.
It could have been a win-win situation, but for that, the Western countries should have been much wiser.
Germans and visitors from around the world will celebrate the anniversary Saturday, the night freedom came to Berlin. But peace between East and West has remained elusive. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Berlin.
A news break from VOA Asia. In an extremely unusual case, South Korea deported two North Korean fishermen Thursday after finding that they had killed 16 other crew members on their boat and then fled to South Korean waters, according to officials in Seoul. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Two leading United Nations agencies warn that growing mental health disorders among children and adolescents are driving young people to engage in increasingly risky, self-destructive behavior. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund are co-hosting their first conference on the urgent issue. The three-day conference opened Thursday in Florence, Italy. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
WHO and UNICEF report up to 20% of adolescents globally experience mental health disorders, with half of these conditions starting before age 14. They note most of these cases are undetected and untreated. This, they warn, is resulting in alarmingly high rates of self-harm, suicide, and anxiety. Chiara Savili, a technician in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, tells VOA this crisis has no borders. She says children in both low- and high-income countries face depression, anxiety, and emotional distress. She notes the majority of young people live in developing countries,
where they may be exposed to a range of risk factors that, like poverty or chronic conditions, including HIV or migration and displacement and violence. And these are all risk factors that have an influence on the psychosocial well-being of young people.
She says adolescents living in richer countries also have to contend with violence. They face stresses related to unstable families, bullying at school and social media, and a wide range of other difficult conditions. WHO reports depression is one of the leading global causes of illness and disability among adolescents. It says suicide is the third leading cause of death in adolescents between ages 15 and 19. Servilli says the stigma and shame attached to mental illness are major barriers to getting young people the help they need.
The lack of awareness about mental health means that both parents as well as and families and teachers and adolescents, they do not recognize their experiences as related to mental health conditions. The other big challenge is in relation to the availability of care providers and trained human resources.
Servilli warns mental conditions that go untreated have serious short- and long-term health consequences for adolescents. The inability to deal with their problems, she says, often pushes young people into alcohol and drug use, unsafe sexual and reproductive practices, violence, and other risky behaviors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, organizers of a major horse jumping exhibition in Helsinki, Finland are redefining the term horsepower. They're taking more than 100 tons of waste from hundreds of horses and converting it to electricity. The renewable energy project has grown at the annual event over the years and now meets all the exhibition's power needs, with some left over to heat nearby homes. VOA's Jim Randall narrates our story.
Organizers of the FEI World Cup Jumping Show in Helsinki are converting horse manure from its equine athletes into electricity to run the event and heat homes in the Finnish capital. The International Equestrian Federation is showing how sporting events can support sustainability.
We had a vision to do something for making a cleaner world, and we didn't have a clue how to start. But then we jumped into a sponsorship and partnership with Fortum, big international energy company, and they came up with this manure invention.
Horse manure power helped heat the Helsinki International Horse Show in 2017. The project grew, and the next year, 235 horses produced 112 tons of manure, which fueled 168 megawatts of electricity. That's all the electricity needed at the four-day event, with a little left over for heating 26 small flats in Helsinki for a month.
Something else that does need to be done, because with all the oil and the gas pollution, it's really not good. So it's really cool that from horses we can actually get electricity.
The main manure to electricity power plant for the show is Fortum Järvenpää. It provides heat for 1,250 customers in the area. During the event, Fortum Horsepower delivered wood-based bedding for more than 200 horses staying in temporary stalls. The manure bedding mixture is then hauled to the power plant, where it's utilized in electricity production. An estimated 135 tons of manure bedding mixture will be created during this year's event. Jim Randall, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. And visit our voanews.com program page. See us on YouTube, follow us on VOA Asia Twitter, and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Tony Pollack, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.